And jobs were the topic on Capitol Hill today. After taking a snow day yesterday, Senate Democrats made their way back to the Capitol today and rolled out their plan to create more jobs. Several leading Republicans have endorsed measures in the bill. That means, for now at least, the effort is being called bipartisan. But, as NPR's David Wellner reports, there are already doubts about the bill's prospects.
Senate Democrats are keenly aware that Americans seem to care more these days about the high unemployment rate than they do about the ruling party's stalled health care legislation. So when Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid announced today he's bringing up a new jobs bill, he made it clear he thought Americans need a new message.
The message that they need is that we're doing something about jobs. We don't have a jobs bill. We have a jobs agenda. And we're going to move forward on that jobs agenda. The first phase of that is going to be this afternoon.
But Reid added that because so many senators can't make it to Capitol Hill because of yesterday's Olympic-sized snowstorm, there won't be any votes on a jobs bill until after next week's President's Day recess. What's notable about this new effort at encouraging job growth is that Democrats have reached out to Republicans to find some things that they support for what all agree may be the first in a series of measures. Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden declared the country is hungry for bipartisanship.
What the country is looking for is getting beyond gotcha politics, and instead of scoring political points, they want to see Democrats and Republicans come up with some ways to score some policy points.
The bill proposes to spend about $90 billion on priming the job pump. It includes a payroll tax break for employers who hire workers who've been unemployed for more than 2 months. There are $20 billion in it for a year-long extension of the highway bill. And there are other tax breaks for business and those who buy bonds financing infrastructure projects. Arizona's John Kyle, who's the Senate's number two Republican, says he assumes it will be adopted by the Senate in fairly short order.
I don't agree with some parts of it. I'm sure some of my other colleagues don't agree with things that I like in it. But it's an effort to bring together a group of things that a large consensus can be developed around and to get it passed.
But Arizona's other Republican Senator, John McCain, has a dimmer view of the jobs bill.
I'm concerned about how it's paid for. I'm concerned about loading it up with other extraneous provisions, which seems to be the habit we've gotten into around here. So I withhold judgment until I get a chance to see how much extraneous stuff is added onto it and how much does it increase the deficit again.
And some economists question whether giving tax breaks to firms that hire more workers will really lead to more jobs. Gary Bertless is a jobs economist at the Brookings Institution.
A lot of the money will go toward supporting employment gains that would have taken place even without the tax subsidy. So the government has given up revenue. Companies are better off. They paid less income taxes, but they don't really have any more people on their payroll on December 31st than they would have in the absence of the tax credit.
So can this jobs bill pass? Majority Leader Reid seemed doubtful about whether GOP support for it will last.
The Republicans, I don't know in logic what they could say to oppose this, but we've seen since Obama was elected, they have opposed everything. They're the party of no.
Too many times, Reid said, we've started out holding hands and wound up pointing fingers. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
And yesterday, the fashion world was gathering in New York City for the start of New York Fashion Week. Their excitement over the big event turned to mourning as news that one of the world's most celebrated fashion designers had been found dead, apparently a suicide. Britain's Alexander McQueen was known for very fine tailoring, but also provocative ideas like lobster claw shoes, skull scarves, runway models wearing headwear made from trash. McQueen was the son of a taxi driver who had made it to art school. One of his teachers was Louise Wilson.
Many of the things that he did for the first time were very shocking, and they got taken up by people and made mainstream, and now they're just part of the sort of vocabulary of what everybody does.
Alexander McQueen was just shy of his 41st birthday when he was found in his London apartment. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. Morning Edition was edited by Greg Myrie and Bridget Kelly. The editorial staff includes Rena Advani, Shanita Anderson, Theo Balcom, Anne Hawk, Kitty Isley, Jordana Hochman, Maeve McGoran, and Denise Rios, with Shannon Rhodes and Sasha Woodruff at NPR West. The director of morning programming is Ellen McDonnell. Morning Edition's theme music was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Renee Montaigne.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. A little over 2 years ago, a 38-year-old pediatrician named Amy Solomon collapsed on her treadmill at home. She died of what was discovered to be a rare, undiagnosed heart defect. The day she died, Amy's parents, Roger and Jenny Rosenblatt, drove from their house on Long Island to their daughter's home in Bethesda, Maryland. The Rosenblatts have been there ever since, helping their son-in-law take care of three children who were 6, 4, and 1 when their mother died. Now Roger Rosenblatt has written about this reconfigured family in an exquisite, restrained little memoir that's filled with both hurt and humor. It's titled Making Toast. Rosenblatt is known as Boppo to his grandchildren. He's had to relearn how to be a parent. And one thing he's rediscovering is that children have no respect for sequential thought.
It really is something I hadn't entirely forgotten, that no matter what you're doing, you will be battered with questions. To say left field doesn't even begin to describe how odd the questions are. So eventually your reflexes develop in that direction and you're able to answer the craziest questions. How tall will I be? Do marlins have lips? Although some of the questions, I must say, do get to things that are so interesting, I want to research them with the kids. Sammy, the middle child, who is now 6, Sammy asked me, what are years? Why do we have years? And that began a little investigation on our part into how long years are on other planets and that sort of thing, which interests him very much.
The title of the book, Making Toast, comes from one special skill that you have as a grandfather.
You're very kind to phrase it that way. It's my solitary skill, my only skill. But I tell you, I am really good at it. It's worth developing a specialty, and my specialty is making toast. So I come down very early in the morning. I come up very early in the morning, set the table for the children, and then when they come down, make toast for those who want it, sometimes cinnamon toast, sometimes regular toast. The only reason that I wanted Making Toast as the title is that it is a simple gesture of moving on. Every morning, there's the bread, and you make the toast, and you start the day. And so even unconsciously, it became a symbol of how to live our life.
You say at one point in the book that there are things that you simply don't want to know, and one of them is you did not want to know, at least when you wrote that, how rare Amy's heart condition was.
I didn't. Jenny had a much more quasi-scientific or medical attitude towards it and wanted to know exactly what had happened. I knew enough of what had happened to satisfy me that I did understand why our daughter had died. But the more I talked to people, the more I got the idea that this was so rare, that the angrier I got, asking the questions that all parents ask in this terrible situation, all people ask in this situation, why us? Why should the odds have been so stacked against us? So I did not want to know the answer to that question.
You mentioned your anger there, and there's a part of the book that I was hoping you could read for us where you're talking about the anger, especially in the early days after Amy died. This is on page 5.
Road rage was a danger those early weeks. I picked fights with store clerks for no reason. I lost my temper with a student who phoned me too frequently about her work. I seethed at those who spoke of Amy's death in the clichés of modern usage, such as passing and closure. I cursed God. In a way, believing in God made Amy's death more, not less comprehensible, since the God I believe in is not beneficent. He doesn't care. A friend was visiting Jerusalem when he got the news about Amy. He kicked the wailing wall and said, "You God." My sentiments exactly.
You come back to this question of God and his place in your life and how it shaped, if at all, how you dealt with Amy's death at several points throughout the book. And why don't you talk a bit about how you came to an understanding of that?
Well, as I have told other friends, it would be easier who do not believe in God. It would have been easier for me if I had not believed in God. Therefore, I would have just cursed the bad luck of our daughter's death. But believing in God, the God I do believe in, is the God who doesn't care, James Joyce's God who stands back paring his fingernails. That seems to me a sensible, if you're going to believe in God, if you have that leap of faith as I do, then the God one that seems much most comprehensible to me would be the God who set us spinning and said, good luck. What happens, unfortunately, with that conclusion about God is that when you are yourself stricken, when you are brought to your knees, then you become entirely superstitious, as I did, and say, well, you should have cared. You should have known. You should have spared this one wonderful young woman with her three young children and her life barely lived and who was so valuable as a doctor to others. You shouldn't have done it. I realize as I say that the God I am talking to is not the God of my comprehension. The God of my comprehension said, I'm sorry, I did the best I could.
This whole question, I guess, of faith and God shapes also how you perceive Amy's spirit, and you talk about this too, that you really feel her spirit, you say, only fleetingly. And you know what comfort it brings to other people who can feel that the dead are nearby. You don't have that, it sounds like.
I don't. There was a moment, which I describe in the book, when Ginny and I were waiting for our youngest son, John, to come by train around Christmas time. And I felt this tapping on my forearm. And it wasn't a breeze and it wasn't a flutter of the garment. It was an actual tapping, like one person comforting another. And I looked to Ginny to see if she had done it, and she had not, and I never felt it again. Once in a while, once in a rare while, a breeze or something gives me an idea of Amy's presence, but it is not in my nature to believe in such things. It is in Ginny's nature. She believes in it very strongly. And in many of our friends, too, who have lost loved ones in their families. That's by the way, as an aside, that's the trouble with one of the many troubles with a situation like this. Suddenly, you learn of the deaths in families that you had never known before, of people you'd known your whole life. It is like a terrible secret society holding this grief inside. And I thought, I never knew that about you. Or worse, did you tell me that and did I forget it? You know, because until it happens to you, there is a kind of casual way you look upon other people. Death is something that happens to others, you think, until it happens to you.
I'm fascinated by that tapping that you described. What did you make of it, especially as someone who doesn't, as you say, believe in these things?
Well, as a writer, I have to believe in invisible things. So when it happened, I had no choice and no other explanation than to believe it was Amy tapping me saying, you're doing okay. I mean, that's our standard, you see. It is the only reason that we can keep Amy alive with us, to think that she is approving of what we're doing and how the children are being reared and that we're doing as much as we can. This is a way of immortality. This is a way of keeping the dead alive, to do what you think they would have wanted.
Roger Rosenblatt, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Roger Rosenblatt's memoir is titled Making Toast, A Family Story. There's an excerpt at npr.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The fashion world is mourning the death of designer Alexander McQueen. He's been called the hooligan of British fashion, known for edgy designs, a bad boy attitude, and an impeccable attention to detail. McQueen's body was found today at his apartment in London. There are widespread reports that he committed suicide, but no confirmation yet of how he died.
McQueen's life story was as dramatic as some of his designs. The son of a taxi driver, the youngest of six children, he left school at age 16 and went to work for a Tony Savile row house, whose highbrow clients included Prince Charles. McQueen later launched his own line that was anything but refined. And Washington Post fashion writer Robin Givon has covered many an Alexander McQueen fashion show, and she joins us now to talk about the late designer. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, do we know any more details about his death?
So far, no. I mean, nothing has been confirmed either via the family or through his spokespeople. So at the moment, we just know that his body was found.
He kept in touch with his fans and others by tweeting constantly. Were there signs based on those communications of any kind of depression? His mother had died recently.
It's so hard to tell from tweets, right? It's 140 characters. But, you know, he was a complicated guy, and not so very long ago, his friend Isabel Blow committed suicide. And she was a British editor and stylist who had sort of discovered him and supported him throughout his career. So, I mean, there were clearly recent events in his life that were quite sad.
Can you give us a sense of his work, Robin? The most striking example recently, I guess, were those incredible shoes that look like some sort of lobster claws. They were called armadillo shoes. And I'm going to leave it to you to explain to our listeners exactly what they look like.
Well, they sort of look like reptilian claws with 6-inch platforms that his models were asked to navigate his runway wearing. You know, I would describe his work as flamboyant and designed to provoke. Much of what he did often, you know, sort of made you scratch your head and ask, is he sort of for or against women? I mean, he really, you weren't quite sure if he was empowering them or if he was subjugating them.
He's known for his outrageous, flamboyant, over-the-top fashion, but he also had an impeccable sense of tailoring and design. If you actually looked at one of his garments or one of his handbags, the workmanship was absolutely beautiful. He seemed to combine both things.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why he was really a cut above. You know, he came from Savile Row, and that's, you know, that's serious business when it comes to tailoring. And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, you sort of see the really provocative stuff that he put on his runway. But at the same time, the First Lady has worn Alexander McQueen suits. And, you know, you would sort of never put those two people together. But she, I have to assume, was sort of drawn to the tailoring in those suits.
Robin Givon, it's always good to talk to you. Thanks for coming back.
My pleasure.
That was Robin Givon. She's a fashion writer for The Washington Post. She was speaking with us about British fashion designer Alexander McQueen. His body was found today in his London home. He was 40 years old.
This is All Things Considered. Weather is the big concern on the eve of the Winter Olympics in Vancouver. A mix of rain, snow, and fog have hit the outdoor venues, threatening postponement of some events and creating challenging conditions for others. But the relatively warm weather is no surprise to an American cross-country ski technician who has spent 2.5 winters at the Olympic course. He's been quietly testing how to grind the bottoms of cross-country skis so that Americans ski fast even in the worst weather for speed. NPR's Howard Berkus has his story.
In a rain-soaked subdivision in Squamish, British Columbia, the garage door of a small ranch house hides a massive $75,000 grinding machine and dozens of cross-country skis resting on racks on the walls.
Okay, now listen very carefully because I'm going to show you one of our proprietary top-secret U.S. ski team grinds. This is one that could give us an advantage, all right?
Zach Caldwell pulls a ski off the wall and slides its base across a round, coarse, and spinning stone.
Okay,
The stone was etched by a diamond cutting tool with a nearly invisible pattern of angled lines. And as the ski emerges from the grinder, it too has the same pattern.
This one is a winner. This is a good one. Yeah, very well proven.
In the last 2.5 years, Caldwell and an assistant have tested more than 6,000 combinations of grinds and skis and snow and weather conditions. It's been an exhaustive search for the perfect ski-based patterns that fit the kinds of conditions cross-country athletes are likely to encounter, specifically at the Olympic course near Whistler. According to Caldwell, no other Olympic team, including the Home Snow Canadians, have been testing and grinding on location for so long.
In my experience, it's entirely unique. Here we have the opportunity to be very specific, and because the grinder is close enough to the venue that we can be grinding skis the night before a race, we have the ability to respond in an extremely specific way to the conditions that are coming.
Caldwell ended up near the Olympic cross-country venue when his wife became coach of a Canadian youth ski training program. He left a thriving ski grinding business in Vermont, trucked his grinder to Squamish, and approached the U.S. ski team, which provided about $60,000, a donated pickup truck, and a volunteer to help with the testing. All that gives the American skiers some home field advantage in one of the world's most maddening climates for skis.
If you were in an environment where the prevailing storm system is incredibly moisture-laden and then passes over an ice field and crystallizes to a very, very sharp level and then falls into 100% humidity near freezing conditions, you have a very challenging situation where there's a lot of moisture and very sharp crystalline snow.
And that's what you have here.
That's what we have here.
The sharp snow crystals tend to grab skis that glide over them, and the heavy moisture creates friction between ski and snow. The right patterns ground into the base of a ski can dissipate the gripping effect of the crystals and moisture, allowing the skier to glide more quickly. Finding the right patterns is elusive because the conditions in this marine climate change quickly and can mix sun, rain, and snow, all at the same course on the same day.
I see a lot of confused faces around here, and I know I spent the first year here really making skis slow. The snow acts in ways that are really contrary to expectation. Frankly, we get our butts kicked if we don't learn the snow that's local to the area.
To learn the snow and the response of different grinds, Caldwell and ski tester Eric Nielsen set up speed tests on a snowy hill in Whistler.
6163.
Okay, we have a loser.
That was a big loser.
Caldwell punches the results into a spreadsheet on his laptop as Nielsen heads up the hill again on different skis with a different grind. Caldwell says the right grind on the right skis on the right skier in the right conditions can shave significant time over the course of a race.
I'm talking about the difference between 15th place and first place.
It could be that much of a difference?
Yeah, in the right conditions, falling snow in the right conditions, there will definitely be people taken off of the podium because their skis aren't good. No one's going to win the race because of the skis, but there are people that are going to lose because their skis are bad.
Have you come to conclusions about the snow and the snow conditions here?
Yes.
And they are?
I'll tell you in March.
By then, the U.S. Nordic ski team hopes to have ended the Olympics with the first American medals in the sport in 36 years. In fact, cross-country skiing is considered one of the possible breakthrough sports for the U.S. team, given recent World Cup success for several skiers. Team officials in Caldwell hope the 2.5 years of testing and grinding will help give those athletes a winning edge. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Vancouver.
And you can see what those grinding patterns look like at our website, npr.org. You can also follow our coverage of the Vancouver Winter Games on Twitter. Find us at NPR Olympics. That's all one word.